This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown. 28 people died at the hands of the shooter that day, including Adam Lanza himself. Those deaths changed many people's thinking and shocked the nation in a way that even other mass shootings had not. But sadly, they represent a tiny fraction of the number of deaths by firearms across the country. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that in 2010, 31,672 people died from firearms, and only 35% of those deaths were from homicides. After Newtown, the debate between gun rights and gun control activists became more heated than ever. Many states like Connecticut passed tougher gun control laws, but many others passed more protections for gun owners. Legal gun sales rose nationwide in the wake of Newtown, and many thousands of other guns were used illegally in crime that continues to plague our cities. Today, Where We Live, we will wade back into the gun conversation, but we'll focus on hard numbers and personal stories of guns in America today. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. Also, if you go to our webpage, WNPR.org, you can find links and infographs in this story on a page called Guns in America by the Numbers. I want to welcome in our first guest. Matthew Miller is co-director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's an associate professor of health policy and management at Harvard University. He's spoken with us about these issues in the past, and he's one of the foremost experts on gun violence in America. Matt Miller, thanks so much for coming back on our program. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Matt, I guess first I want to ask you, because we've had a few conversations about this in this past year, what has changed for you in the work that you do or how you look at guns in America in this last year?
Well, what's changed for me is the sort of outpouring of grief and attention that was paid initially to the massacre in Connecticut almost a year ago today. It raised lots of hopes among people with whom I work that the outpouring of grief and attention would result in a sustained interest in making some real change about the way that the conversation about firearms in the United States takes place, and that it would have an abiding influence on the kind of political and cultural debates that took place. That seemed to be the case for the first several months after the massacre, but I would say that today it doesn't feel a lot different than it did a year ago in terms of the kind of conversations that are taking place. One brighter perspective is that at least there's been some initial funding of research into ways to prevent firearm-related violence. There have been a number of proposals that have been put out calling for research into the ways to prevent firearm-related injuries and death. It's a very small proportion of the total budget devoted to preventing morbidity and mortality in the United States, but at least it's a start.
One of those reports and studies that you're referencing, we're just seeing this week, the American Psychological Association funded a study that it ends up showing, Matt, something that you've known for some time, is that the most effective way to combat gun violence is to treat the problem as a public health issue. So maybe through that lens, you can speak to us a little bit more about the numbers that you found. If you look at guns in America as something that is a public health problem, it is a slightly different conversation than when it's about the Second Amendment or whether it's about how effective guns might be in schools or in various places to stop crimes. Talk about this public health aspect of guns in America, if you would.
Sure. So a good starting point is to recognize the statistics that you put forward at the beginning of the show. There were somewhat over 31,000 firearm-related deaths in the United States in 2010, the last year for which we have national data. That's almost as many people who died in car crashes, and if you look at the death toll among people under 40 in the United States, the leading cause is firearm-related injuries. That itself speaks to the enormous problem of firearms as a public health issue. One of the statistics that people may not be as familiar with is that 2/3 of the firearm-related deaths in this country are suicides, not homicides. And the guns that are used in suicides are by and large guns that have been in the home for a long time, are legally owned and legally possessed. And so when we're thinking about a conversation around the public health problems related to firearm-related violence, we have to focus both on the illegal trafficking of firearms that are often used in interpersonal violence and homicide, but also about the guns that are legally owned and possessed but pose a big risk to people who are either have mental illness, substance abuse problems, or going through a hard time.
We're talking with Matthew Miller from the Harvard School of Public Health. He co-directs the Harvard Injury Control Research Center, and we're talking about guns in America today. Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the Newtown shootings. We'll have live coverage throughout the morning on WNPR. More information on our website, WNPR.org. I want to bring into our conversation Alvin Chang, who's data editor for the Connecticut Mirror. He's been looking at the numbers here in our state, and he joins us now by phone. Alvin, welcome to our show.
Good to be here.
Your story in the Connecticut Mirror looks at gun deaths in just the last year in Connecticut. What did you find?
Well, we wanted to ask the question, how many people have died from a gunshot wound since Sandy Hook until now? And that's a very, very difficult question to answer. And I knew this going in, but, you know, it shows the point that this data isn't widely available or available at all. And we're looking for, you know, kind of the holy grail of this open data. We want it to be accurate. We want it to be timely. And, perhaps most importantly, we want it to be accessible so that law enforcement policymakers can actually look at these numbers and respond to these numbers. And so that feedback loop is actually helpful and not just us on a radio program talking about 2010 CDC numbers. So that's, you know, that's one of the first things that I ran into while working on this piece.
You say it was difficult to find this information. Give me an example of why. Why is it so hard to find out how many people died by gun deaths in a state in a year?
Right. So this is an interesting question because Connecticut has its own uniform crime reporting system, which basically means that every local law enforcement agency has to report their crime numbers to the state every year. Those numbers are published annually. There's no running count of, you know, number of gun deaths, number of murders, number of, you know, whatever. That doesn't exist. The other problem with that those numbers is that from agency to agency, the way that they define these different categories, you know, they're not keeping the exact same database. They're not feeding it. There's not some universal way of tracking this data. So that's, you know, I can't look at those numbers and say, you know, this is how many there have been. And, you know, I was able to include 2012 data. But even then, part of me said, okay, well, I don't know how much I trust this data because I've known uniform crime data to be, you know, very unreliable. And the FBI also has their own uniform crime data database, but and that, you know, that tracks the more national number. But that's a voluntary the participation in that program is voluntary, so it's not always accurate.
I want to bring Matt Miller back in, and it seems as though this is one of the things you've struggled with over the years. Of course, in the more than a decade and a half now that you've been researching gun violence in America at Harvard. Mm-hmm. You've essentially been working blind in a lot of ways because of federal restrictions on gun violence data. Talk from a federal level, on a national level, about the difficulty of just finding out numbers like the ones that you and Alvin are working with, Matt.
So as Alvin said, the most recent data that we have at the national level from the Centers for Disease Control, which is a central repository for the data that come from each of the states, is 2010. So even if we were trying to get a sense of what's happening in the United States today, the most contemporary data that we have that's fully representative is 3 years old. That shouldn't be. We have electronic records that are collected at the state level, and as Alvin's excellent work has done, you can get data that's far more current than is available centrally. And there's no reason that we can't put together an electronic program that allows us to have more contemporary data. But some of the other issues having to do with the kind of information that we can get and the funding available to encourage research, that's been a problem for the past 17 years. It's only, as I mentioned, over the past year, after President Obama said that we should devote $10 million to firearm research over the next year, that there have been there's anything like an encouragement to do firearms-related research. But $10 million of funding from a multi-billion dollar budget is nothing, especially when you think about the toll that firearms take in this country. 31,000 lives a year, more deaths among children and young adults than any other cause, and yet we're spending $10 million for the entire research community. One grant to study heart disease or cancer or AIDS is more than $10 million. I can't in good conscience, for example, encourage my graduate students to devote themselves to a career in firearm-related injury prevention when the promise has been a single year at $10 million. Whether it becomes a line item that's a recurrent investment in our society to reduce gun violence or not remains to be seen. But even if it were at a $10 million per year level, that's hardly enough to sustain a community of researchers, a vibrant, sort of intellectually vibrant community of researchers devoted to reducing firearm-related violence in this country.
And I certainly don't have the numbers off the top of my head. You very well might, Matt, because of the work that you've done in comparing firearm deaths in America to car crash deaths. But it would seem to me that the auto industry and regulators spend quite a bit more than $10 million a year trying to figure out how to make our cars safer.
The statistics that you're asking for, there are about as many firearm-related injuries as there are car crashes. Not quite. So there were 31,000 firearm-related injuries. There are about 33,000 to 34,000 car fatalities in 2010. And you're right. We spend millions and millions of dollars trying to reduce the risk that people are going to die or to get seriously injured in car crashes, and we're spending $10 million to try to do something about firearm-related violence.
We're talking with Matthew Miller from Harvard and Alvin Cheng, who's data editor for the Connecticut Mirror. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. If you go to ctmirror.org, you can take a look at the infographic that Alvin has put together about firearm deaths in Connecticut in just the last year. We talked about how you gathered the data, Alvin. What does the data tell you? How many people have died by gun deaths in the last year?
Well, first I'll talk about where I got the data. So Slate.com did this very interesting project shortly after Newtown. They wanted to aggregate a national database of gun deaths since Sandy Hook. And this was aggregated by volunteers who were looking through news reports. So if you think about the number of things that could possibly be missed by media organizations, and then add in another layer of something that could be missed by volunteers who are sifting through thousands of news stories trying to find however many every day, that leads to an incredibly incomplete data set. And then on top of that, you get the two-thirds of gun deaths being suicides, which are largely unreported in the news, and you have a data set that's incredibly incomplete. So that was part of what they wanted to show, and at the same time, it was one of the better data sets that's up to date. So we counted 99 in their data set from and including the Newtown shootings up until November 25th. Now, I know that those numbers are not accurate. And virtually anyone who has any a vague knowledge of this knows that those numbers aren't accurate. But while putting this together and talking to, I talked to Mike Lawler, who's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice in Connecticut, and you know there were some signs that we might be getting data sets that are more up to date and cleaner in the future, but as of now, you know, nobody, even Mike Lawler, didn't have a better, more responsive, more up to date way of getting this data, which. You know, I got 99. That is not even close to the number of gun deaths in Connecticut.
So Matthew Miller, as you take a look at federal statistics, the ones that you're able to see, do you have confidence that the numbers that you're able to talk about are indeed the right numbers, or do you believe that there are more deaths that happen by guns in America than you're able to report and work with?
Well, I would say that the number of firearm-related deaths that are recorded centrally at the National Health Statistics Center are probably a fair reflection of the number of firearm-related deaths that occur. Whether the intent is attributed properly is another question. By that I mean, let's say we have 31,000 firearm-related deaths in the United States in 2010. I bet that's a pretty good, accurate number. 19,000 suicides, 11,000 homicides, and about 1,000 accidents. We know from some excellent reporting by Mike Luo of the New York Times, and also my colleague Kathy Barber here at the Harvard Injury Center, that firearm accidents are undercounted among children. They're often attributed to homicide, firearm homicide, and in older people they are overcounted. So the exact mix, whether some accidents are misclassified as homicides, or when some homicides are misclassified as accidents, is an open question. But the total number of firearm-related deaths, I would say that's probably a pretty accurate number.
We're talking with Matthew Miller, co-director of the Harvard Injury Control Prevention Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. Also joining us is Alvin Chang. He's data editor for the Connecticut Mirror. If you want to learn more about this, you can go to our page at WNPR.org, Guns in America by the Numbers. Alvin Chang, thank you so much for sharing your work with us. I appreciate it.
Nice to be here.
When we continue, we will be talking with Matt Miller. We'll also be bringing in some other guests. Before we break, we want to read an email from Woody in Manchester. The volume of urban homicide day after day towers over the numbers of lost lives at Aurora, Newtown, and even the Texas Tower, yet it goes largely unreported outside the local area and nearly totally unremembered. We will be remembering some of those stories about the daily drumbeat of violence in our cities coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Join WNPR tomorrow for special coverage from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the one-year anniversary of the Newtown shootings. Colin McEnroe and I will host a three-hour call-in show with guests and reflections. Beginning at 9 o'clock, we will pause for the statewide ringing of the bells at 9:30. At noon, join Ray Hardman for a special broadcast of music we've gathered and recorded in memoriam. Today, we're looking at gun violence outside of Newtown. In 2010 alone, the CDC reports more than 31,000 people died from firearm-related injuries in a country whose history is entwined with guns. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Matt Miller from Harvard joins us. He's co-director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School for Public Health. We'll be bringing in some other guests in a moment, but I want to get to Jay's call from Ellington. Hello, Jay. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Thank you so much for taking my call this morning. So I guess my question is, and maybe it's more of a comment, but I know in the aftermath of the massacre in Sandy Hook, there were lots of news reports about the numbers of deaths related to guns in America. And I thought I remembered a report regarding the NRA and their activities, if you will, that suppressed the ability for researchers to gather gun-related numbers or you know, deaths, the numbers of deaths that were caused by guns.
Yes.
And I wondered if your guests could comment on those activities and if there's any movement on sort of overturning some of those activities so that some of these numbers can be more readily available.
And Jay, thank you very much for your phone call. I made reference to that briefly in introducing Matt Miller before, but Matthew, maybe you can explain a bit more about what Jay's talking about.
Okay, so Jay brings up two issues. One is the obstruction that the NRA and other pro-gun groups have been instrumental in putting up against doing sound, politically neutral research on firearm-related violence in this country. The second point, the second issue is whether that involves suppressing information about how many deaths occur by guns. It does not. You know, we have a good measure from death certificates of the number of people who died by gunfire and a good estimate of how many of those are suicides and how many are homicides and accidents to a good first approximation. What has been impeded for the past 17 years has been research into how to use those numbers. The basic mechanism that was used was a defunding of the center that was devoted to reducing firearm-related violence in this country back in 1996, and which had a chilling effect that lasted almost two decades on the willingness of people within the Centers for Disease Control to fund firearm-related research. There was also a stipulation that no research should be done that constituted advocacy, which of course is true no matter what discipline you're working in. None of the research that had been done previously was advocacy. It was information about what was happening. It was politically neutral. But the stipulation within the bylaws of both the CDC and eventually the NIH, as I said, had a chilling effect on the willingness to fund firearm-related research, and that was the great impediment to growing the field and reducing the toll.
I want to get to a phone call quickly from Simone, who's calling from West Hartford. Hello, Simone. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I'm a retired teacher, and I used to survey my students about who had guns in the home, and often it was approximately one out of four. And I read recently that in Democratic suburbs, that was probably close, the reality is something like 27%. I saw that in the New York Times not too long ago. Anyway, I'm very disturbed about the number of guns that are in people's homes. And I've had two students over the years that killed themselves with guns that belonged to their parents. And I just think that it's irresponsible to keep a gun in the house if you have anyone that's prone to depression. It's a decision that a person makes very spontaneously according to people you've had on your programs on NPR. And I just think it's irresponsible for people to keep guns in their homes. And kids figure out how to gain access to these guns, even if they're, quote, locked up. My students also told me in just about every case that even though their parents had their guns, quote, secured, they knew how to gain access to them.
Hmm. Simone, thank you. And you were a teacher in West Hartford?
I was. I retired a few years ago.
Simone, thank you very much for sharing the story. Matt Miller, quickly, before we go to our next guest, I'm wondering if you have some comment on that, because that's, again, part of the story, the easy accessibility of guns for young people, especially, who use them to take their own lives all too often.
Yeah. In this country, more than half of all the suicides that occur involve firearms, and the vast majority of those firearms are firearms that are legally owned in people's homes. When children and young adults kill themselves with firearms, they use their parents' firearms. If those firearms are stored unlocked and loaded, the chances that they're going to die by suicide go up several fold. We know that a gun in the home puts everybody in the home, not just the gun owner, at much higher risk of suicide, 2 to 10 times higher, depending on how that gun is stored. One of the, I think, the most striking manifestations of that risk is the way that suicide is distributed across this country. If you look at the suicide rates, the overall number of people who are dying by suicide in a given year, it's very tightly correlated with the prevalence of guns in people's homes. So states like Connecticut or New York or Massachusetts, where I live, where gun ownership is relatively low, rates of overall suicide are relatively low because rates of firearm suicide are relatively low. If you go to other areas, Mississippi other places in the South or in the mountain states, overall suicide rates are much higher, as much as 3 or 4-fold higher. And the reason that they're higher is not because rates of suicide by non-gun methods are higher. They're not. It's because rates of suicide by gun methods are so much higher. Mm. We're not more suicidal in Americans are not more suicidal in Mississippi or Alabama or Colorado than they are in Connecticut or New York or Massachusetts. The rates of suicidal behavior, of depression, and so forth are really not any different. But what distinguishes the places where people are killing themselves at much higher rates is the fact that people have guns in their home.
When I heard Matthew Miller present those statistics at a conference we did at Wesleyan University, it was chilling indeed. It's one of the reasons why we're talking about the numbers here on our program today. Matthew Miller joins us from the Harvard School of Public Health. Stand by for a moment, Matt, because we're going to bring in a few other guests to continue our conversation at 860-275-7266. Our first guest is Reverend Henry Brown, founder of Mothers United Against Violence. He was just in Washington, D.C. He's just returned, and he's spoken with us about these issues in the past. Reverend, it's good to see you once again. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I also want to welcome in by phone Shafiq Abdusabur, who's a New Haven police officer and chairman CEO of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement. He's also spoken with us on the program before. Shafiq, welcome back.
Thank you, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm going to start with you, Reverend Brown, and maybe you can just tell our listeners what you were doing in Washington, D.C. the last few days.
Well, we were down, you know, the anniversary of the shooting that happened out in Newtown is coming up on this Saturday. I've been working with Newtown to galvanize and bring people together in unification to battle this epidemic called gun violence. And the reason we went there was the National Gun Vigil against gun violence. And you're right, I heard what the caller said that about the number of suicide committed by guns. It's staggering. I think like we had 32,000 people that were killed by gun across America since Newtown. And 15,000 of them, I believe, was committed by suicide. So we went down with this vigil to bring people, like I said before, from America together. It was so successful. We had over 1,000 people. You know, we had people from all over America victimized by gun. And one thing that we find out is that no pain or grief is different than other pain or grief. So I was encouraged by what I saw. I saw a specter of hope because I always said that the only way we could turn this gun violence down is the people have to do it. You know, if we wait on our politicians and people that govern us to do the thing, it's not going to happen.
One of the difficult things about this post-Newtown conversation has been something that you and I have talked about in the past, which is that an event like this, when so many young people especially are killed at one time, it galvanizes us. It makes us think, and it sometimes draws us to our corners. No matter what we feel about guns in America, we take very strong stands. But the violence that you and Shafiq deal with on a regular basis in our cities, it seems to be, as I called it earlier, a kind of a dull drumbeat that just goes on in the background and Americans just do not pay attention to. You make the case often, Reverend, that hundreds of people have been killed in the city of Hartford over the course of the last several years, and we have not galvanized as a community in the same way. To talk a bit more about that and whether or not you think that that's changing as well.
I've seen hope down in Washington. And the reason I said that is because you're right. The conversation about gun violence in urban communities have been very, very dull. We had a slogan and we went down to Washington with Newtown, and that is honor with action. Of course, you know, we remember that massacre that happened out in Newtown, but Newtown has started a movement to not only talk about what happened in suburban communities, but as well as what happened in the urban communities. We had people at first from Oakland, California. They was invited, Chicago, Aurora, Colorado, Arizona, people from all across America. And now the conversation is about the urban violence. And I think it's a conversation that was long overdue. But I seen a specter of hope, because the conversation that I heard was that the people in Newtown didn't want it to be about Newtown. They wanted to be about the people all across America, particularly urban people in the communities that have been affected by gun violence. This one Newtown resident, Monty Frank, he said that, you know, he said before December the 14th, you know, he said, I knew the problem was there, but I wasn't paying any attention to it because it hadn't affected him. And I think that's the thing that has been stymieing the movement towards gun violence in the urban community. People really don't want to get involved because it don't really concern them. Mm.
Shafiq, I'm wondering if you can pick up on that. I mean, your city of New Haven has had, sadly, the last year and a half a bad year, and there have been far too many people shot and killed in the city. Do you see anything changing regarding this issue?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that we just have to, as I always say, have a direct conversation. I mean, the difference between Sandy Hook and what's happening in many of the inner cities, it is the culture of the individuals and the demographic and ethnicity of individuals that are being murdered. And so I think what has happened is, in the African-American community, Black people have been getting killed through gun violence for decades. This has been happening since the crack wars of 1985. Many African-American communities, the leaders and organizations, have still been saddled with a very difficult task of trying to figure out themselves how to address this issue. There's been a lot of conversation that it starts in the home. There's been a lot of conversation that it's the government's fault. So there's a lot of back and forth of who needs to take the lead on this. But, you know, my position has always been the African-American community just has to take full responsibility of these large amounts of crime and gun deaths within their own community. My cousin recently was killed in New Haven. She was killed by a Black man. And a young Black male who, you know, through the conversation, he appeared to be at the particular time, you know, drunk or high and really wasn't knowing what he was doing. He has to take responsibility for that. And we as African Americans must take responsibility for that young man who people knew he had a gun before he got involved. So that's number one. The other part of this is, how do we change it? How do we get in front of this? You know, New Haven, last year, I believe we had 17 homicides. We're at 18 this year. I think part of the difference is the African-American community, a particular case, working with government officials, working with the police department. You know, New Haven has a police chief that, unlike a police chief we've had in a very long time, that is focused on gun violence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the keys, that when you have an issue of gun violence in your city, the police chief that comes in has to recognize it's a problem, realize the shortcomings of the department, and then reorganize in order to address that. So, you know, New Haven, obviously, I work here. I put my 100% in, as well as many of the officers here. New Haven Police Department is focused on addressing gun violence because we recognize it as an issue. Now, when you take that into other cities where you have maybe a frail relationship between the police department and the community, and all of them are not perfect, especially with the African-American community where there's challenges, but I think we have to put that dialogue on the table. And what happened in Sandy Hook and what's happening, say, in Chicago and New Haven and other places, it's different. It's still gun violence. But the difference is, in a place like Sandy Hook, where you've got folks voting on a regular basis, where you've got many homeowners, where you've got people involved in the political system, that community is able to galvanize immediately, take ownership of their shortcomings within their community, and go forward and address it. And I think that's the difference between what we're seeing with many of the suburban shootings and much of the ongoing urban violence.
And we're going to get to some phone calls in just a moment. I know, Reverend Brown, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I wanted to make that comment about the police and the importance of having a relationship with the police department. I agree 100%. In Hartford, through the effort of Mothers United Against Violence, we have established that type of relationship with the Hartford Police Department. Also, what he said about the police chief is true. We had recently in Hartford just had a police chief with the compassion to tackle gun violence. And I think that that's where it really starts if you're going to reduce the gun violence. Also, you know, I just want to comment on, you know, it's a different environment when you come from a broken home. 67% of the African-American homes are headed by single mothers, you know.
Well, and it's – I'm glad you brought that up because here's something I want to talk to you about. And I honestly, I was just talking to our producer, Tucker Ives, on the way into work, and it hadn't really dawned on me. We've been trying to figure out for an entire year what drove Adam Lanza to do this, and we get this police report that doesn't tell us very much about his mental state. But I started thinking about Adam Lanza in the context of many of the young African-American men that you're talking about and that Shafiq is talking about. People who come from a broken home, who are living with a single mother, who may very well have undiagnosed mental health issues, which is a much bigger problem in the African-American community, frankly, than it is in the white community. And it seems, Reverend Brown, as though maybe there is a little bit more something to the Adam Lanza story that we can relate to urban violence than we maybe thought at first.
It is. Listen, I advocate against gun violence wholeheartedly. You know, we talk about the guns, but we're not talking about the mental capability of people. When you come from a 06120 zone, that's what we call our death zone here in Hartford, our kids see yellow tape daily. Not only do they see the yellow tape daily, they see dead bodies daily. And not only do they see that, they see the blood from the dead body pouring out and rolling down our streets. So, yes, that's problem with the gun control. But I'm wishing that people would concentrate on this effort about what's wrong with a person, because there has to be a sign before somebody committed an act of violence towards another human being. We just had three young women lost because an individual with a gun decided that, you know, I would end this because he just had a gun. We have to realize that there has to be something that could tip the scale to say, hey, we need to do something about him. You know, it's going to be small in your mind, but that small thing could save another human being's life.
Shafiq, quickly before our break, maybe pick up on that and talk a bit about how, from a law enforcement perspective, you actually do that. I mean, you want to make sure that you can intervene if you know someone has a gun, if you know someone has a problem. But what do you, what does the community do to help?
Well, if I could just address that last piece you put about the Adam Lanza and what happening in the urban community.
Yes.
Is that one thing that I see common in the African-American community, where the perpetrators are often African-American males, they have no fathers in the home. Mm-hmm. Adam Lanza had no father in the home. There was a disconnect between him and his father, as the same perpetrators in the African-American community. Adam Lanza voluntarily desensitized himself to violence and homicides and that kind of behavior, where in the African-American community, young boys are involuntarily desensitized. So the common thread for both of them, they're desensitized to violence, and they don't have any father's engagement. That's the key.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Shafiq Abdusabur, who's a New Haven police officer and chairman and CEO of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement. Joining me in studio is Reverend Henry Brown, who's founder of Mothers United Against Violence. He just came back from a vigil in Washington, D.C. Matt Miller is also with us on the phone. He's co-director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. We've got some phone calls of yours we want to take at 860-275-7266 when we return. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about guns in America, some of the statistics in real-life realities 1 year after Newtown. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to get to a few phone calls. Steve's calling from Stores. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, a number of things, but the first one would be I'm always concerned about the consistency with which we talk about public policy between, say, guns, and we've heard about some automobile deaths. with guns, I am a gun owner, but I'm also an economics researcher. And with guns, we talk about banning guns, banning sales. But we don't talk that way about dealing with automobile deaths. We don't talk about banning cars. We don't talk about banning people from driving, whether or not they're drunk. We do obviously work on drunk drivers, and like we should be working on people who store guns irresponsibly. But we don't talk about those people who are responsible not being able to continue to use their vehicles. We don't even talk about the types of vehicles that may be more or less hazardous, such as a very large SUV with the potential to do much more damage to somebody in a different vehicle or to a pedestrian. So there's consistency. Also, I do have one question.
Yes.
The gentleman talked about the number of injuries from firearms being somewhere around 33,000 a year and number of deaths from cars being somewhere around 35,000 per year. If I got the numbers close, did he mean deaths by both, or injuries by one, and deaths only by cars, excluding non-fatal injuries by cars?
Well, and Steve, let me put that to Matt Miller, who's the keeper of the statistics here. Did you get Steve's question, Matt?
Yeah. So I was talking only about fatalities. There are about 34,000 car-related fatalities, and about 31,000 related firearm fatalities. But we do, apropos of the other points that Steve brought up, you know, we do have restrictions on the kind of vehicles people can drive. People can't drive tanks. Cars are highly regulated in terms of being able to brake. They're inspected every year. And so we do exercise a great deal of oversight with respect to motor vehicles. We also have a wonderful surveillance system that looks at what happens when people die in car crashes.
Mm.
We have tons of information. How fast was someone going? Were they making a left-hand turn? Were they wearing their seatbelt? How fast was it? Did they hit another car? Did they hit a tree? Did it occur in a roundabout, and so forth? And we've learned an enormous amount about car-related fatalities because of the surveillance system that we have, FARS. And as a result, we have been able to enact very sensible regulatory legislation, putting airbags in cars and seatbelts, and changing social norms by letting people know what the actual facts are. And as a result, over the last 40 years, death by car crashes has gone down over 75%.
Well,
and
it seems as though we've become safer in our cars over this time. I want to just quickly get to a phone call because we're running quite low on time. David's in Stonington. Hi, David. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you. It took you 45 minutes to finally get around to the mental health issue, which is the big crux of the matter, that these people that are committing these mass murders are all mentally ill, and the one thing that seems to be a common denominator in many of them is they're playing violent video games, which goes to the part of the desensitization that you were mentioning earlier. Appreciate the show, and I know you're short of time, but I've got a gun, and it's locked up safely, and it all boils down to who's pulling the trigger or who's driving the car.
David, thank you very much. I'm really glad you called. I want to bring in Brandi Zadrozny, who's a researcher and reporter for The Daily Beast. She combed through data on school shootings since last year. We do just have a few minutes left, but Brandi, thank you so much for joining us. What did you find as you looked at school shootings in this last year? Because it's something, obviously, a lot of us are thinking about right now.
Hi, thanks for having me. So we found that there were about 24. And this is just using media reports, so there could be more. But there have been at least 24 school shootings since the Newtown tragedy. And, you know, most of them weren't, you know, the type of tragedies that come to mind when you think of school shootings. You know, there's not Adam Lanza's roaming school hallways, you know, shooting indiscriminately. But a lot of them are suicides. A lot of them are less reported in the media because, you know, the death toll is much lower, or there are no deaths, or the injury was only to the shooter himself. But guns in our schools is a problem, And so that's basically what we found. And then we also found that there were 17 deaths over the past year and 24 injuries.
And what's the divide between urban and suburban or rural shootings in schools, Brandy?
Well, so it seems to run the gambit. So we have there were several school shootings. Florida had the most, I think, at 5, and then Georgia came in second at 3. And, you know, some of these were gang-related, but more often than not, they were they seem to be just troubled teens targeting, again, themselves or some labeled victim of bullying. But they really ran the gambit. Like, there's not a specific type of school shooter. It's all types.
Brandy Zadrozny is a researcher and reporter for The Daily Beast who combed through data on school shootings since last year. Brandy, thank you so much for joining us. If you want to learn more about her reporting, you can go to our page, WNPR.org. Reverend Henry Brown, this idea of school shootings, we think about in the Adam Lanza case, but for young people in urban settings, there's the threat of gun violence all the time. There are school shootings and discharge of firearms all the time. This is, again, something that we don't pay probably enough attention to.
Right. You know, I want to go back to what the difference between auto accidents, fatalities, and gun violence is that you have an option with a gun. What I mean is that your intent to kill or to harm someone else or harm yourself, that's a mind thing. With an accident or with a car, it's usually an accident. But gun violence is not accident. It's with the intent to either kill somebody or to harm yourself. With the urban violence, is the expression that these young people can step outside of the door and purchase a gun. We're not talking about people don't have the right to own guns, but we're talking about, listen, our communities are overflowed with guns and drugs and poverty. Nobody want to talk about those. They don't want to have those conversations. We need to start having those conversations because young men are dying. And it's not only black men that are dying, it's Hispanic men, any other person of color that live in the
community. Not talking about AR-15s. We're talking about illegal handguns. We're talking about handguns that flow into the cities in numbers that we can't even count.
Right. We're talking about that scrub. We need that scrub law to be in effect so we stop the gun trafficking. You know, if you stop the selling drugs and the Florida guns into the urban community, I believe you will slow down the crime. But these kids have been regulated to, just like the police officer said, these kids have been are regulated to this environment. They've been forced into this environment. So I have to protect myself with a gun. You know, a lot of kids don't want to shoot people, but they are forced by the environment that you know people have guns. So it's forcing an innocent kid with to go out and purchase a gun because, look, I can't walk across the street. I can't walk down in my own neighborhood. And I have intent of improving my neighborhood. But we need to really, just like the conversation down with Newtown and everybody else that we was with down in Washington, we need to have these conversations. And people need to talk about the disparity between the races, too. I think that's the most important piece. We need to start talking about that disparity.
And Reverend Henry Brown, that's a conversation I promise we will continue here on the program in the weeks, months, and years to come. Reverend, good to see you once again. Thank you so much for being here. Reverend Henry Brown, founder of Mothers United Against Violence. Also thanks to Shafiq Abdusabur, New Haven police officer, chairman, CEO of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement. Sir, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, John.
And thank you to Matthew Miller, co-director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. If you want to learn more about some of the work that he's done, you can go to our website, WNPR.org. Matt, as always, good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, John.
We will end with a few emails. John emailed us a couple of statistics that are grossly unreported. The lives saved by guns and violence and other crimes that are deterred by a fear of guns. I feel if the media spent more time reporting gun success stories, we may have fewer deaths. Another comes in. From Kalila Brown Dean, I'm sorry that we don't have time for more of these tweets. We'll continue this conversation tomorrow where we live.